Just to clue you in that the sessions I'm doing this week are related to a major study on economic life that is almost finished in the ELCA and will be hopefully coming to our board and in print by later this fall. So it's the kind of document that I think gets into a lot of issues that are of current relevance to lots and lots of folks in our congregation. It's a whole variety of issues. The back of that has an abbreviated outline so you can get somewhat of a sense of the various issues and topics that will deal with. So as I said in other sessions, if you'd like to get a free copy of it, give your slip of paper to me and we'll see that you get one in November. The topic today is jobs in the global market. And I really would like this to be a participatory discussion because I'm going to try to throw out some observations, some trends, some of the kind of broad brushstrokes of what's happening and why is it happening. But I would like you to kind of jump in because I think all of you bring the kind of living experience of these issues that I want to benefit from hearing, and for you to either challenge some of what I'm saying or to throw some in and say, hey, you know, that's kind of like what happened to me. So just to let you know that will be kind of our style of operating today. The overall theme of this, and as you can see, the overall theme of the study is that petition of the Lord's Prayer, give us this day our daily bread. And each day I've been emphasizing a different word or phrase in that. And today I really highlighted the this day part of it, because if we take as a kind of normative understanding, as I suggested the last couple of days, that for us as people of faith, one of the central normative kinds of convictions that we need to bring to matters of economic life is that all should have a means for somehow acquiring the livelihood that they need. And that the economic system, economic life, should be in service of sufficient, sustainable livelihood for all. Now, if that is kind of an operating premise that we as people of faith bring to that, and I don't think it's just unique to us, those of us who are Christian or Jewish or whatever, but if that's a central conviction, then I think one of the central things we need to come to grips with is what in the world is happening to jobs today? The this day accent in that petition, and we spoke on Monday about how there's a very real countercultural stance that we as Christians are bringing to matters of economic life every time we pray that petition. To counter some of the self-sufficiency of, well, you know, you make it on your own and you're an autonomous person, or, you know, it's me, myself, and I. Yesterday we talked about the us in terms of, you know, those who are living in poverty and what that means. And today, trying to wrap our mind around what it means to think about our jobs in a global economy. One of the, basically, the point that I'm going to be making is that I think we are living in this day in an era that is quickly seeing the end to the job as something that we commit ourselves to for the rest of our lives, an end to that era of the job as what will somehow carry us through from the time we finish school till the time we retire. And certainly there's some very real generational shifts in this. In the process that we're involved in the fall of 94, we did lots of listening post surveys in different parts of the country. And I think the reason we felt real need to focus on livelihood was the incredible sense of insecurity that we heard in so many places around the country among people who are generally white, middle class, if not upper middle class folks, folks that in previous eras we would say, hey, you know, they can count on some security, they can count on the job being there. And of course, as probably all of us are only too aware, with various developments like downsizing and all the rest, that security that we could count on in the past is gone. So one of the ways I sometimes think about this is there's generational differences here. There's people who have retired or are near retirement who could count on having that job for a long time, and that things got better. You know, the post-World War II generation was a time of incredible growth in the standard of living and prosperity. Incidentally, I think helped significantly by a number of government grants that were part of that World War II kind of period. And then a kind of middle-aged group, I'd count myself among that, for whom that security is not quite so taken for granted anymore. And the fact that in the 80s, there were a lot of people in manufacturing jobs who found their jobs ending. The phenomenon in the 90s is that it's been white-collar jobs, managers, lots of folks. And I see from some nods, and I suppose if I ask for a raise of hand, either we ourselves or people pretty close to us, how many of us could think of people who've been affected that way, who have what one would think of are pretty good jobs, and yet all of a sudden they find themselves looking for work? So I think that raises some critical questions, among other things, for us as church, for thinking of people having a sense of calling or vocation. It raises serious, not that vocation has ever been equated with having a job. It's something that comes out of our baptism. It's much, how we live, how we serve the neighbor in whatever setting, in whatever job or not job we have. And yet I think that sense of vocation and worth and identity, all those deep kinds of issues can really be thrust into a state of crisis in the midst of all this changing realities of jobs that's going on in our day. In one of these listening posts that we had, I think it was in the Silicon Valley in California, there was a man who I think was in an upper management job before he lost his job, and there may be some chairs. You want to bring some from there?
Here,
we'll sit up here. Yeah, here's some. And it was an incredibly impassioned kind of appeal that he made to us. Two of us would go in different pairs around different parts of the country to hear what people had to say about economic life and how it relates to the faith and the church, etc. And this man said, here I was, people at church didn't know how to relate to me. It was like, he's supposedly made it, but now he's out of work. He said, and my own pastor didn't know. The most he could do was say, well, John or whatever his name was, there's some odd jobs at church, you can maybe help out with that. He says, I was dealing with some deeply spiritual crises. Who am I? Of what worth am I? And therefore, I think the ministry of the church in responding to, in thinking through how to, not just how do we help people, but how can the church be an empowering presence with people to ask questions, to work together. And I think certainly there are cases of churches in areas of high unemployment trying to do that. But I think in a lot of cases, the church is sometimes the first place that one drops out. So let me just mention some of these observations or some of the kind of mega developments today. Approximately two-thirds of the U.S. population is employed, and admittedly, many in satisfying jobs that pay fairly well. In other words, I don't want you to go away from this saying, well, we're dealing with a totally bleak picture, because I think the fact of the matter is, and probably for most of us who can afford to come to Holden, we're probably among the more privileged group in a lot of cases, and many of us are in satisfying jobs that pay fairly well. Statistics came out in April indicating that over two-thirds of the new jobs created in 94 and 95 actually paid better than average. In other words, it isn't true that the new jobs are all low-paying jobs. Now, of course, we can get into the matter of having the qualifications and the education and all the rest for those jobs. And even though unemployment rates are low, you know, we get these great economic news of, well, it's dropped another so many percent or a tenth of a percent or whatever, that obviously overlooks many who are unemployed over the short term or become discouraged over the long term and thus no longer counted in those unemployment figures. My hunch is if we did a survey, we could probably count on some of us in this room who would consider ourselves underemployed in jobs below our abilities or that are less than full-time. Many people today with full-time jobs earn incomes too low to support a family. Secretary of Labor Reich has said in a speech not too long ago that basically $7.60 an hour is the minimum required to lift someone, and I think this was a family of four, but it may have been family of three or four, out of poverty. You know, so obviously, even though the minimum wage has, I think now, just been raised last week or, you know, over the next year, you know, it's still significantly below the level that could raise a wage earner out of poverty.
Karen, is that assuming a 40-hour week?
Yeah, full-time job would require that amount. More and more jobs are part-time or with temporary contracts. Just be interesting. How many of you are basically doing contract work? In other words, you are your own, you're kind of self-employed and hiring yourself out to do contract one kind of thing.
Sounds like an adjunct faculty, so I contract, you know,
for courses. Right. And I think there's more and more of that going on. Certainly, you know, working in the churchwide offices, we go through some real things because a lot of, well, it's cheaper, you know, we can get just the person we want for this part, this, you know, and yet there's, I think, some underlying issues there about job security, certainly in educational institutions, all the adjunct, and of course retirement issues there too. So there's a lot of a lot of movements there where having a job for 30 years with X company is increasingly not the case for more and more people. And then finally, workers and managers feeling increasingly insecure and vulnerable to trends and decisions over which they feel they have no control. When we did these listening posts, and I mentioned the other day, one was with a number of fairly high-level international business and finance people in the New York City area, and I think we thought, well, gee, these are people who really have some influence and power, and the incredible sense of powerlessness that many of them expressed. Now, again, we could say objectively, yeah, they probably have a lot more power than many of us do. And yet that sense of being so much captive, you know, quarter by quarter driven, and if you're, you know, if the profit doesn't reach a certain point and the fear of what will happen to the stock value, and being so in bondage to that and feeling at times that they're sacrificing their souls in the process. Those are just a few indicators of what's going on. Let's hear from you some of the other trends, job-wise, that you experience or others that are close to you have experienced.
Give you an example. We come from an agricultural area in western Iowa, you know, Iowa, the capital of the world. What our independent farmers are finding now is there are three or four companies that virtually control the hog market and are taking control of the beef market too.
Right.
And our farmers are finding it difficult to get any kind of price they want.
Yeah.
Iowa has just passed a law that says if you raise more than, I think it's 5,000 head of hogs, in the course of the year, you must have lagoons in order to handle the manure. So what the corporations are doing is they're coming out to our farmers, they're trying to get clusters of small farmers, maybe five or six that are adjacent to each other. Each take 500 or 1,000 hogs. And they don't really want, all they do is they get a guaranteed price out of it. They also get all the feed. In other words, they won't be farmers anymore. All they do is tend hogs if they want to market. And really, all the corporation wants for this is they want to be able to spread the manure on the land without having to buy lagoons. So in exchange for having a place to sell the hogs, which they really will never own, but to turn in at the end of the period, they can become part of this corporate outfit. So it's truly changed the picture. You have a totally independent family farm.
And they can walk away in 10 years and just leave the mess.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I
but
think
the corporation gets out of building these multi-million dollar lagoons to handle the waste.
No, I think probably the most dramatic changes are in agriculture. This, I mean, it, the statistics that we use in here is that between 1995 and 2005, I mean, there's been, you know, huge drops in the percentage engaged in farming or earning their livelihood from farming for this century, and it'll be another 20% drop in the next 10 years.
There's the old joke about the farmer who wins the lottery. His friends ask him, what are you going to do with the money? And he says, I think I'll keep farming till that's gone.
it was probably one of the most, one of the listening posts that made the deepest impact was in rural South Dakota. And as a young farmer said, or she said, we are not just a dying people, we are dead. You know, I mean, and it was incredible kind of thing. I just ran into the pastor a few weeks ago, and he said, well, they're still struggling in there. But he says that, you know, the kind of despair in the midst of that is really profound. Yeah.
Well, I think, and this gets at the issue of what big business is about, both in the U.S. and in the transnational economy. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the census data from 1980 to the early 1990s, the lower one-fifth of Americans in terms of adjusted dollars earned 2.5% less. The upper 1% gained 22.5%. And so when you look at that, as middle class people, we have to think of generally, middle class here I would say, and maybe upper middle class, you have to think of, yes, we have that insecurity, but the real issue also becomes that what is the nature of business, and that the nature of business is to extract as much as possible, and that it's not just us that are hurting, but that you're also that lower one-fifth of the population is also being squeezed even greater than we are. And that's right. Those are the people that really are suffering. So I think a lot of the times we're dealing with the psychological trauma of insecurity and having our sort of typical life threatened, and yet in it's got even more concrete problems at the lower levels.
Right. No,
well.
I very much agree with that. And, you know, the objective realities are quite different. I think part of what the current situation enables us to do, though, is to see that even for those of us that are middle, upper middle class, there's a kind of insecurity there, which might provide some possibility for some connecting with others who have felt, for whom insecurity has been the way of life, you know, for a long time. Also, to reinforce your point, there's in our document, there's one graphic that actually got from somewhere else, but it's basically a cocktail glass that, you know, in terms of the, and if you're dealing with income, it's bad enough. Of course, if you're dealing with wealth, then it's even worse. But it's like the top part of this you know, glass is full, that's where most of it, and then it's just a little bit here, and of course it gets very small by the time you get to the bottom fifth in terms of who gets what percentage of the total national income in this country, not to mention the rest of the world. Yeah.
I have quite a bit of frustration hearing a church leader talking about the suffering resulting from economic change in our world that's reality, and not helping us cope with change, which is a fact of life.
Right.
And to build up institutional resistance to change as a means of support, I find morally bankrupt.
Right. It's not just a matter of saying, well, we've somehow got to dig in our heels and say how awful it is. And that's not where I want to end up with it either.
But that's where I hear you coming from.
Well, I'm trying to raise those realities of what the situation is so that we can realistically and
as a people. Well, let's go a little further then. The economist Paul Romer of Stanford says that we're going through a technological revolution that will upset society 10 to 20 fold what the Industrial Revolution did. Mm-hmm. And the means to successfully survive that are putting a premium on public education, mm-hmm. to adapt life to change, mm-hmm. and break down the resistances to change, mm-hmm. with working well to adapt and cope with change.
Well,
and one of the things that people as people have a real problem with, and where our solution can come a lot, is listening to our children. Because children don't know the fear of change. They get it from us.
That makes wonderful sense, and yet what is the government doing about education?
The problem our government has is we're in a global economy, and therefore our government's a small player in the global economy. We've spent tomorrow's dollars already, we've got to pay them back before we're about trying to control the world economy with our government. So that's going to require some fundamental social change.
Well, and what you're moving into now is what I wanted to get into a bit, because I think, you know, looking at the realities of technological change, which are good and bad, you know, it's not just, you know, what I'm trying at it. In fact, I was going to read an interesting letter here from last century. It was a letter that Van Buren wrote to Jackson, you know, just decrying, you know, this horrendous new invention of railroads that is, you know, just wiping out the canal business and whatever. In other words, it gives us a little historical perspective on some of the knee-jerk reactions. You might say, oh, well, technological change is bad, or that even, globalization is all bad. So part of what I want to get into is a much more nuanced understanding of that, but then how can the church look realistically and helpful at those changes rather than just kind of, you know, throwing stones at it all and say, oh, well, that's all terrible, and because that doesn't help anybody then, okay?
And so. There's another element of economic drive that's very real in our country, and that's the age wave, the generation, mm-hmm. change of aging.
That's right.
And it's a major social issue of planning that we haven't touched.
Yeah.
And the solution is ultimately for Christians caring for people.
And that there's going to be more and a larger and larger percentage that are post-retirement, and certainly some of the deficit issues.
Or retired when they're no longer able to work, where 65 is an arbitrary government-imposed retirement age that means absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. And where Social Security's eligibility, by the time I'm looking at it, I'm 70 at the earliest. And it means nothing to me. Because if I want to get what is projected to be mine, I'll turn to my neighbor and ask him for a half his paycheck. My neighbor asked me for that today, I don't think I'd be willing to give him that.
There's some predictions that could be as high as 86% if there weren't some changes because of the age, mm-hmm. ballooning of that group. Let's just pick up a couple of other comments here.
I don't know if this necessarily ties in, but he said he referred to learning from our children, and something that we're seeing in our area. We too live in Iowa, upper northern Iowa, 35 miles south of the Minnesota border, and something that I'm seeing with the young people between like 25 and 30 is an attitude that we are not going to do what our parents did. We're not going to work 80 hours a week and we are not going to give up everything for all these material things. We want to be able to enjoy our life too, and work 40 hours a week and have a life. And they are, you know, they're saying we'll give up. We won't have as much so that we can take time to smell the flowers.
And to tie in with that is also the young people who are getting out of college and can't find jobs, and are, there's, okay, I have to get my master's before I can even get a job, and then I'm not assured of a job, and then a lot of the young people are going back home, and you're having a real trend of parents having to support or, you know, help with, whereas at one point at 25, you know, they were already established in a place. But that, I've seen that in our area, personally.
And kind of people in the middle being squeezed from both sides.
Yes.
You know, what's going to happen to mom and dad, but what's going to also happen to the...
Yes, that middle kids. Or the sandwich.
We're still home.
Yes.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Trends that I've been seeing, I'm here on the West Coast, I'm in international trade and business, and the trends that I've been seeing are centralization of companies, so that branch offices are closed, and people who are still representatives in those branch offices no longer see it as our company, but their company that I'm working for. Mm. And companies that do maintain the offices they had before no longer have desks for the employees. The employees work out of their homes. Mm-hmm. And so they are facing feeling that the company has invaded their privacy. They no longer have a company life and a home life. The company is able to invade their home life any hour of the day, any day of the week. Mm. And they have a responsibility to answer that call, because the company has given them email and has given them cellular phones and has given them fax machines. And it's their responsibility to pay back if they want to keep that job.
So what might seem on the surface to be a kind of independence, of having freedom, quote, to work at home, you're suggesting has
and also
something quite different going on.
I'm hearing from a lot of those people that they no longer have that collegiality that they used to have. They couldn't just lean over the divider or go to the next office and say, how would you handle this problem? Or where do you think this should be priced at? Or how do you handle that shipping problem? Because that person may be 40 miles away. Or in their car.
Right. So that sense of interconnectedness with one another, and you know, on Monday when we were laying out some of the theological undergirdings for this, how much the biblical understanding is that we are social relational beings as opposed to autonomous beings. In other words, there's a lot, some theological groundwork for this that we try to lay out there. And I think that, you know, that becomes a very real issue in terms of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And another aspect of this, and maybe some of you have some experience with this, is the whole trust factor of, you know, being out and loyalty, you know, when there's not the loyalty, when it's much more transient, well, either we'll contract with people or, you know, you're moving to another place that the corporation has a site or whatever. And again, I think that becomes a theological issue. You know, how do we talk about those bonds that unite us? And I think there's a very real sense in which businesses as a social organization have been based on there being some of that there, more than just economic entities. A phrase that I heard not too long ago, which I think relates to this, is we do have a kind of rotating door of people going in and out. Before long, a company can develop, a real kind of memory loss, kind of corporate, you know, there's no sense of a shared, a shared history, kind of dementia, kind of a corporate dementia that kind of sets in, that is part of what we theologically understood it is important for institutions to thrive. Okay, any more of the what you seen going on in terms of jobs that you're aware of?
I'm in the business that sees a lot of reduction or change in jobs. And I deal a lot with professionals losing their jobs. But I also see a lot of them starting new business. A huge majority of them starting new business. And gaining a whole lot better wealth and a whole lot more loyalty to their employees than where they came from. Because that's what they were missing.
And the whole entrepreneurship kind of movement. Are there some of you that are in that, you know, have left a big company and are now your own entrepreneur in a sense? Or probably there's some in the village if we took an overall survey. Let me just mention what I think are three of the factors related to this, and we've touched on these already, so I'm not going to say that much because I think the people in this room are well aware of these. Certainly one of those is the continued rapid pace of technological changes, and technological changes that can be good as well as bad, that can serve human well-being, in other words, that we can theologically evaluate as positive, as well as some changes that are not that positive. And I think one of the ways in which we can look at that overall is that technological change, when we think of what's been happening to jobs in that sense, raises the dilemma of freedom and responsibility. For us as Christians, there's that ongoing kind of tension between being free and yet being responsible for what the effect of changes are on human well-being. Human beings are the agents of technological change, which we bring about through human freedom. But if technology becomes an end in itself, it can gain control over us. It can become an unquestioned power of domination over the livelihood of human beings. But through the responsible exercise of human freedom, technology can also be used toward ends that are accountable to the well-being of God's creation. And so, from out of that kind of faith framework, I would suggest that ongoing consideration needs to be given to how decisions about technological change are made, who makes them, and how we can best prepare for the technological changes that are occurring. And certainly one of the most pervasive of those is just the way in which computers are basically the essential aspect of so many jobs. And of course, that raises questions of those who don't know computers or who, for one reason or another, are unable to use them. You know, certainly those changes are coming with such rapidity that at times it's hard to reflect and to say, what does that mean in terms of who human beings are, how we interact with one another, especially in a day when so many of the economic exchanges are, you know, through all of these means that are a far cry from the kind of face-to-face economic exchanges that one might have thought about in an earlier era. You know, what happens to the humanness that's a part of the economic exchanges that are a part of the workplace? Second factor, and again, we'll get into some further discussion of this in a little bit. Certainly the incredible effect that the globalization of the market has had on us, and that certainly in the 1990s we're dealing with the fact that the market is the global reality. And as I think was alluded to before, it's we're dealing with a reality over which no government really has control. One of the works that I find somewhat provocative and helpful is a book by David Corton called When Corporations Rule the World, and it's coming out in paperback, so I'm going to make sure the bookstore orders some copies for the future. But he has a number of interesting diagrams, but one of them is to look at, in this global market, the rise of large corporate power. Huge corporations, for example, a company like GM that has
good slip.
Country, yeah. That's right. Well, that's that was an appropriate slip, because Corton's point is that large corporations like this have become the de facto governments of our world. And part of the reason I'm laying this out is because, as we heard at these listening posts, people of faith and the church ecumenically, globally, I don't think the stance of the church is necessarily just to kind of denounce all of this, but to be aware, to engage with these realities, because in the face of this, about the only organization that is global is the church. In other words, this far surpasses global, you know, national governments. But he describes how what's happened in the global economy, and there's obviously lots of other ways this could be described, is there's various localities, you know, whether in this country or throughout the world. And in the past, one might have thought of some of the kind of economic activity that goes on between, you know, within those localities or between localities. In other words, lots of economic activity here. And that more and more of all that is just being kind of sucked into the center, a kind of centralization that he talks about. Others have used other ways of talking about that. But so that decisions of large corporations in powerful ways affect a lot of these localities. And what happens is, rather than seeing themselves in interaction with one another, more often than not, they find themselves pit against one another. You know, the whole developments in terms of, well, a company decides to move to Mexico, or competition between a company in Minnesota and one in North Carolina, where, you know, there's not union wages and it's a little cheaper, and there's this and that, and all the factors of moving to where production is likely to cost less. I think a lot of this certainly has emerged. A lot of the ethical dilemmas of that have emerged with, for example, the whole Nike thing with Michael Jordan. I mean, I come from Chicago, so I can mention Michael Jordan. All of those dilemmas of what are workers paid and under what conditions do they work. Now, and I don't think that's a simplistic kind of thing, because as Nike and some of these other companies will quickly come back, well, the fact of the matter is we're paying better than the workers could earn doing other, you know, comparable work in those companies. I mean, I think one then could raise the further question of what, you know, what happens to those homespun businesses. And, you know, if in fact they're going to all be wiped out in favor of these companies that are part of some large corporation. So I think there's the theological issue here, and I mentioned some things about understandings of sin that I think are important for us when we think about economic life. Certainly, one of the obvious ones is if, in fact, a lot of this is driven by a pure quest for economic gain that is a pretty transparent kind of quest for greed. And certainly, biblically, there's some fairly strong stuff said about that. But I think also one of the ways is that sin becomes a kind of power of domination over us that manifests itself in the world where we live. And we lose a sense of ourselves as historical subjects, as people who can make a difference. And it's like, you know, communities will look at what's happening to them in the face of this large corporate power. And it's very tempting, I think, for us to just kind of say, oh, you know, there ain't a thing we can do about it. Well, I think there are things that can be done. There are ways in which people have tried to work with companies. Early warning systems and communities have developed so that it isn't just a matter of feeling passive in the face of these changes. But I think it's going to take a lot of rousing people to think about, to be aware of what's happening, so that we aren't just, you know, kind of victimized by, you know, by these huge forces of what's going on. I've already mentioned the kind of third theme here that I think is a part of the current picture, and that is the quest for economic gain. Some people today saying, well, should there be moral limits as to how much is acceptable in terms of how high a profit? Now that, you know, that admittedly raises lots of hackles for lots of people, because highest possible profit is kind of a, you know, basic understanding of what economic activity in this country is about. I'm wearing a t-shirt that a friend of mine designed who lives in Minneapolis, and she is very concerned about the huge discrepancy in compensation between CEOs of large companies. And there was a study that was it came out a month or two ago indicating that of the Fortune 500 companies, the CEOs in those companies are paid compensation, that includes stock options, et cetera, that average about, I think it was 196 times what the average worker is paid, not the lowest, but the average worker is paid. So she's developed this chart to make her point, and in the 50s, this is what the discrepancy was. Talks about as the golden 50s. In other words, the CEOs, and of course we're talking of, weren't the huge conglomerates for the most part that were reading about in the newspapers regularly today, but it was 7.5 times. And then this is how, if it had been that same proportion today, this is what the chart would look like. This would be the CEO compensation today. However, I don't think this is the top of it. It starts here, and the shirt maker couldn't make the arrow continuous, but it goes back. And the point is, her point is, this is going on behind our back. And so, again, I don't think that's what you, it seems as though that's a matter that more and more people in our day are raising. I think that's becoming a more public issue in our society. Not saying that, somehow CEOs shouldn't make a pretty decent salary, but when the discrepancy is that big in a way that overlooks how the workers themselves contribute in ways that make that company profitable. And certainly have been noted cases in the paper of, well, so-and-so makes so much, but look at, they slashed so many hundreds, or in some cases thousands of workers. And I think tough questions asked, need to be asked. In some places there's movements to say, well, should there be some kind of a maximum wage law? If so, how would that be determined? I mean, all these, I think, are problematic proposals. But, people just trying to think out loud, is there any way of dealing with this? Or for example, building in some factors so that a rise in CEO compensation would somehow be linked to a proportional rise in the compensation of all the workers. So that if the CEO got a 10% increase in income, that would also be reflected down the line, including the lowest paid workers in a company. And then, of course, just the especially 95 being a case in point with the incredible rise in so many stock values, and now in 96. A number of cases where there were very disturbing headlines in the paper of, well, so-and-so cut jobs, but the stock value went up, or vice versa. Rise in number of jobs, and well, then the stock market takes a dip. And again, I think that's a complex issue too, because far more of us today are invested in the stock market through pension plans. So it's not a matter of trying to simplistically say, well, we can just cast stones at those who are making money on the stock market, but the kind of intricacies of what's going on in our economy today and how that impacts our jobs is a difficult. So that's, let me just stop for a minute and invite some of you to add some other perspectives or to question or some other.
I had one thing, you know, one of the things that the Moynihan Report, you know, kind of accused the poor of the present day orientation. And one of the things that I talk about in the classes I teach in sociology is that the wealthy have a present day orientation too, and that's mm-hmm. part of the nature of corporations. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, while we often accuse the poor of not being able to plan and save for tomorrow, you don't make it in a corporation by setting long term goals and avoiding environmental hazards and making sure that you have stability. You get ahead by doing things now and by making quick profit. That's the whole orientation of the business. And even another part of that is the whole issue, you don't get paid for being socially responsible.
Right.
And recently with Chevrolet, you know, they have the Chevrolet Most Valuable Player of the Game. They spent $150,000 for the scholarships and $360,000 advertising it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so you see this even when you start feeling good about, oh gee, they're giving scholarships to these athletes, they're still getting more. They're doing other things, kind of behind the back. And I think that's one of the most important issues is how do you give this? How can we as Christians say we need to attach some social responsibility? There's nothing wrong with making a profit, but how do you go about saying that it would actually be good business for you to also be socially responsible? And that's a very difficult thing in a bottom line world.
It's also a very difficult thing in a political world. Our government has been leading with micromanagement
mm-hmm.
and not any long-term view. And we deal with governmental crisis. That's how we make decisions.
Yeah. That's why one of the central theological ethical norms that is at the heart of this document we're working on is sufficient sustainable livelihood for all, and with the sufficient and the sustainable intentionally being together there. And by sustainable, it includes environmental types of concerns, but more than that, what can be sustained economically? You know, including the concern you raise of, you know, what's going to happen in terms of this kind of age bulge in the population. And I guess we, those of us who are part of that, it's hard to keep calling ourselves baby boomers because we're a little bit beyond that now. So those long-term concerns, and I think that's where as people of faith, we bring a long-term perspective. I mean, our perspective is that of the whole reign of God. And therefore, that, I think, can be empowering, can give us a perspective that says, hey, it's more than just the bottom line or being quarter-by-quarter driven as to what, you know, the company earnings are for, you know, and of course, everybody waits with bated breath to see what that's going to be at the end of, when was it, the end of June or the end of July or whatever. And I think also, and certainly ecumenically, a lot of work is being done on this by the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility, which has been long been trying to file shareholder resolutions with companies, not necessarily in a confrontational way, but really getting into some dialogue with CEOs to say, you know, around environmental issues, around labor issues, especially now for companies that move their plants to other countries where they may not have the labor laws that we do. Not that ours always work out that great in practice either. So trying to say, how can we, who as Christians have concern for the stewardship of these large-scale institutions, how can we bring those concerns to bear? And I don't think it's just unique to Christians when we bring it, but how do we factor in the impact on a community? The kind of social capital, you know, what's going to happen if we just say, well, we're going to get workers, but, you know, how do those workers get nurtured, developed through the educational kind of thing? A much more holistic as well as long-term kind of perspective. And And I'm increasingly hopeful because I see in more and more places where that's happened. And I think it is often people of faith who can hang in there over the long haul because we bring something other than just the bottom line concerns. I would also want to add to what you're saying that we have one high-level business person from actually from the state of Washington in our task force who's continually reminding me that to be concerned about workers, about community, and about environment increasingly is seen as good business by more and more businesses. And so I don't think it's a matter of, you know, kind of casting stones at all businesses and say they're all only on that bottom line.
And to build on that, Romer from Stanford says that technology is displacing labor as a partner with capital driving the economy. So the pace of change in displaced labor is only going to be aggravated with time. Mm-hmm. And so as a society, we're going to have to learn to cope mm-hmm. with how not to tie our identity to our job
right.
and our personhood to the job.
Yeah.
But it offers a prime opportunity for faith to jump in
yeah.
and build community.
Yeah, and say where in fact is
that. Restore community.
Yeah, and I very much agree with what you're saying there, because I think the important thing is to say, hey, here's a real opportunity as people of faith for us to redefine some of this. I mean, that's why I think redefining, what all gets factored into that. Another point I raised the other day, but I think I'll bring it up again here, is to what degree growth in the gross domestic product, the GDP, what else needs to be factored into, well-being besides just that? And it's far more than just, what happens to communities, what happens to the environment, what happens to our relationships with one another. And I think there's more and more groups in society, many of them not church-affiliated, that are asking those questions, and therefore I think there's incredible opportunities for us as church to connect with that, you know, in our communities, and not just somehow feel that we're kind of a lonely voice in the midst of all of that. So I'm very encouraged by a lot of those hopes and a lot of those examples that of people that are seeking to make a difference. Read another quote, and this will be kind of a final quote, and then if you have some further comments until our time is up. Let me mention a few things I would have gotten into if we had had the time. I think the whole matter of support and power of workers in this changing job market is an incredibly important issue. I mean, we're in an era where unions, only 10% of non-governmental workers are unionized. And that whole matter of, especially if we're dealing with independent contractors, what happens, the examples you pointed to of that worker in his or her home and, the potential exploitation that can happen in this time. And some people, for example, are saying, well, what we need to do is develop some organizations that might be not quite like unions, but people from a variety of occupation who are together in that, but how can there be some joint advocacy? How can we find some ways of supporting workers so they aren't just out there, feeling so vulnerable to all of this? That doesn't certainly take away from the fact that ongoing education and training is also, kind of the basic thing that we're going to have to be facing. And that's where there's a somewhat dismal kind of development. If you look at which sector of our population where there's going to be the biggest upsurge in the percentage of workers in the 21st century. Anyone want to guess what that is? Hispanic workers. And yet, among Hispanics today, there also nationally is the highest high school dropout rate. And especially if we look at jobs that, are more and more dependent on having education in an ongoing kind of way. So I think there's a lot of stuff there. This final quote, and it relates this matter of, you know, our identity and livelihood not being quite so tied to the job. Again, it's something from David Corton. He suggests that we need to shift our focus from jobs to creating, from just having a job to creating and sustaining livelihoods in new ways. Quote, we could be using advances in technology to give everyone more options for good, sustainable living. Sustainable in more than just the economic terms, but certainly including that. If we so choose, instead of demanding that those fortunate enough to have jobs sacrifice their family and community lives on the altar of competition, while others languish in the ranks of the unemployed, we could be organizing our societies around a 20 to 30 hour work week to assure secure and adequately compensated employment for almost every adult who wants a job. The time thus freed could be devoted to the social economy in activities that meet unmet needs and rebuild a badly tattered social fabric. Any responses to what he's saying?
Who has he told this to? And I guess I'm being a little bit cynical. It makes perfect sense what he has said, but we have so many different kinds of people operating at different levels of spirituality and somewhat even, you know, schizophrenic, you know, greedy on the one hand, generous on the other hand, and I mean, how is this going to be pulled together?
Certainly, it's a pretty idealistic vision he's setting forth there.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can see some small things that I would do to help one person, but I mean, we're just not of a like mind in this world. And I guess that is a frustration for me, even more than my financial insecurity or security. Mm-hmm.
Since we're talking about money, and since this is a political year, I'd just like to throw out, think of how much good could be done with all the amount of money that's wasted on political campaigns. Mm-hmm. Mega bucks.
And also thereby limiting who can afford one, too.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. The cynical part of me would like to see us pay the president and Congress and senators the kind of money we offer to Michael Jordan and to Ryan Sandberg. And to, I mean, quite seriously, you know, we pay CEOs multi-million dollars a year, and we pay our president $250,000. Is it any wonder we spend most of the 4 years he's in office taking pot shots at it?
Mm-hmm. I feel just the opposite. I have always felt that our public servants ought to be paid the same wages that we're being paid, so that they will be representative and understanding the problems we face. When we send people to Washington and allow them to be paid three or four times more our wages, plus have all kinds of extra benefits because their job is so hard, they no longer understand how hard it is for us to get our kids through college and to make the payments on our homes and to keep our jobs and those sorts of things. I've always thought if they really are our public servants, like they say they are when they apply for office, then we ought to pay them as representatives of us with the same kind of wages that we're making.
And not only that, they should only want to do it for two terms.
Oh, I think if they want to be public servants for the rest of their lives, that's fine. That's like saying a pastor should only be a pastor for two terms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if that's what they want to have for their
long time. How well they perform.
That's right.
Yeah. Getting back to your response, which I think is an important one to, you know, those kinds of somewhat idealistic kinds of predictions. I guess one of my sources of hope is seeing that a lot of people who through the years have connected with places like Holden have seen this as a place where a lot of people are saying, no, I'm not going to just get pulled into that. You're right, you know. much of the rest of the world is going to continue to operate that way. But I think there's more and more people raising up to the fact that, hey, there's more to life than just working what in some cases is an 80-hour a week job. Last night at the forum, some of you may have heard, you know, Mark Schmidt, who basically left, you know, his fast track in corporate America to come here to be the operations manager, and what that, you know, what that meant in terms of saying, hey, my living is more than just my paycheck.
And actually, I know someone who was offered a six-figure job and said no, and you know.
Those are
tough.
It's a very spiritual thing for him.
Yeah,
thank you. I think it's really hard not to get pulled in. I'm just turned 30, and I'm at a fairly insecure perspective in what the future is going to bring. I don't, through conversation and headlines and listening, I don't expect to have any social security when I reach 65 or 70. If I did get a job with a corporation, I wouldn't expect to keep it, and I wouldn't get my gold watch after 30 years. A lot of my friends and peers back home have definitely jumped right in to get their slice of what piece of pie is left. Because it didn't feel like the pies, there's very much of it left. And my reaction, I guess, has been to not jump in and to take retirement early. And that's why I'm here. I mean, my wife and I quit our jobs in May, and we're on a 5-month trip around the U.S., and we're probably going to break even on it. And we're able to have some insurance, barely, and be able to make it kind of happen. But I don't want to work that 70 or 60 or even 40-hour week to get to the point when I'm 65 to have, or 70, and have the opportunity to jump into Winnebago and cruise around the U.S. or even go on a walker to Europe or something. But it's very insecure, being Generation X, I guess.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that's an important kind of perspective. One last one, and then we'll close.
I think another concept that maybe would bear some more looking at, and I think it's been tried in various places around countries and volume companies, where the incentive to the bottom line can get transferred from stockholders to the people who work there. And I know Delta Airlines and United, I think, both operate by that.
Well, and recently United, which is worker-owned, they decided not to buy out some new company because of what might be the effect on their own workers and others. In other words, it was a clear case of going against, you know, the grain of, you know, buying up one more company. And so, yeah, thank you for mentioning it, because, again, that's something I could have gotten. The figure I've seen recently is we're talking something like 12,000 worker-owned and, in some cases, community-owned enterprises. And I think not just sharing it, other options, like in terms of profit sharing, which also involves risk sharing. So I think those become helpful kinds of models, not necessarily grandiose solutions to the problem, but I think it's some, you know, there's a problems often involved in those too, but beginning to change those understandings of how business in this country is organized.
Or another thought that, you know, part of the Chrysler bailout a number of years ago was that the president of the UAW went on the board of directors there. Mm-hmm. Whether he's the right person to represent everybody, I don't know, but the concept of having employee representatives on the board, I think, might help too.
So that some of the worker owner or worker management kinds of lines.
You know, they've just completed their most profitable year ever.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I was just going to comment. I think one of the things I most liked what you said was about the church is an international entity. That's a real valuable thought for me, because I've really noticed it as we've been talking I thought we were going to talk a great deal about the global economy. And we have been pretty much talking the United States and made a few other examples, but the example that you gave of, you know, kind of dropping out for various, you know, we all have different versions of kind of dropping out, not going to be on the fast track. And when I think of what that would mean in the context of a person in a developing country, I frequently have students from Central America who live in my home who are here to get, you know, the best education they possibly can, to go back to their countries, to get on the fast track in their countries, to try and, you know, I mean, we are really talking out of our perspective of dominance in the world from many different perspectives, and rather, I mean, that could be a whole other topic, but I just kind of want to go back to that comment you made about our church membership being a view of the world organized in a very different way, and how we care for, receive care from, and how we are united. Might be a good thought in the light of our own personal decisions that we make about livelihood.
It certainly causes us to pause a bit before we immediately lash back when we say, oh, look at, you know, what's happened to those jobs, they moved to such and such, or what, you know, we try to think more globally. I'm not saying that there might not be some critical issues of injustice and exploitation. We don't need to raise our voices about some of those situations. But it does, on Monday, for example, I threw out the notion of household of God, because household of God and, you know, management of the household and economy have the same root word. And how can we bring those concerns back into the public discussion in a way that often becomes very short-sighted when we only have this much more limited view. Thank you for that. Yeah.
I'd like to hear from some people here.
If some of you have to leave, some are a little bit beyond, don't hesitate. But those of you who want to keep talking, I'm willing.
I'd like to hear some comments from the people here that, in the best of all possible worlds, what could the church do to help us as church goers to fit in and deal with everything that we're hearing? How can the church help us? Anybody?
Yeah, I feel like we are the church, and what I can do by, if we go, let's say, to the same place of worship, by that community, that we can reach out to each other and fit pieces together that needs are being met, whether there's a job request or a single mother with childcare needs. There's a lot of, at least where we go to worship, the church we go to, there's a lot of things being complemented that take care of a lot of the needs in our community as well as in our city community of outreach. But the real push at our church is that each person is the church, or is a part of the church as a whole. It's not like the church is there to provide for me. We are the church, so we're providing for everyone. So that's, I mean, the perspective I have is, you know, we are the church, so we do whatever we can to fit in what needs to fit in.
I think, you know, at many different levels, the kind of helping out, you know, the kind of basic help there. I think at times the church's voice in advocacy, you know, nationally, internationally, really trying internationally, dealing with most of the global market realities, I think that becomes an important counter, often against enormous odds. So success rate is not necessarily the critical kind of thing here. But I think also then, as we said earlier, you know, helping people to deal with, you know, what are the spiritual sense of who am I in the midst of this kinds of issues that I think the church is uniquely equipped to help people deal with. I think what needs to happen first and foremost, however, is for church to become a safer place where people's struggles with this can be brought out in the open, because, you know, or where some creative envisioning of some
signs of hope can occur. We're going to do a series next week that's more on the spirit-born shoots of hope, trying to not just get into the ain't it awful kind of thing, but how do we as people who are empowered by the Spirit to make a difference, how do we together think of those possibilities? I mean, let me just say, you know, I know we're past this time anyway, but just one final sign of hope for me against enormous odds is a place in the west side of Chicago. The director of this is on our task force, Ethel Mulai, some of you may know of it. And a very poor African-American inner-city congregation in an extraordinarily devastated part of town. Well, through the years, they have developed an incredible array of institutions to make a difference. Not only do they employ 450 people who have helped to transform that community, but each year they provide job training and all the rest for about 500 people. And now, as Mary says to me, well, 60% of the women in our program don't even have a sixth grade education. So, you know, it's enormous odds. And yet, the way in which that whole neighborhood has been transformed and generating jobs and, you know, creative negotiating with major banks, with major corporations. And, you know, that doesn't just happen by people who say, well, that's the way it is. You know, there's a very real sense in which a faith commitment is at the core of what's happened there. You know, that's faith becoming visible in some ways. I'm not saying it always has to be visible in terms of all kinds of success, examples of large-scale success, but in some small ways where people are saying, no, we're not going to just accept this as inevitable, but we're people of hope who refuse to just let the economy or the dictates of economic life become our God.
I think our congregations, more of our congregations, need to be rooted in their community and understand their own community and the needs of people out of the community. It's very easy for congregations to isolate themselves and deal just internally. Mm-hmm. Once they start looking beyond their doors, they find ways in which they can help not only people within their congregation, but people within their community. And I think our worshiping life together strengthens us to do that if we're willing to do it. But we have a lot of work to do there to get people to be willing to take some risks and do a lot more community-based kinds of programs. There's a lot of opportunities there, and people are subtly aware of it, but until they actually are stimulated to begin to work with it, it doesn't just happen. We tend to kind of fall in the same old patterns and not do anything. I think there's a lot of hope in the resources that are there in terms of people and talents in our congregation is tremendous. If we can just get people to use those to affect change even in their own small community.